On Front Next, breaking news. We have exclusive new details about New York City at this hour, preparing for the first criminal trial of a former president. This as the president's legal team is zeroing in on what may be their only hope. Plus, O.J. Simpson's longtime manager is out front. He has 70 hours of footage of his former client, and he's going to share the details of their very last conversation just before Simpson died. And real-life castaways. Tonight, you're going to hear from the pilots who found three sailors who had been trapped on a tiny remote island, found only because they spelled the word help out of palm tree leaves. Let's go out front. And good evening. I'm Erin Burnett. Out front tonight, bracing for Trump. We have exclusive details this hour into the preparations that are right now being made for Trump's first criminal trial starting in just 3 days. Cameras, drones, bomb-sniffing dogs, barricades. Federal and New York City officials have been calling on every resource they have for what will be an unprecedented several weeks. And in a moment, we're going to take you inside the NYPD's Joint Operations Center, where officials are combing over sensitive intelligence ahead of Trump's appearance in the courtroom. That courtroom will be one of the most secure rooms in all of New York, inside a former president and a jury of 12 men and women who will ultimately decide his guilt or innocence. And that jury may bail Trump out. And this is important to consider because you don't usually hear this part of it, but think about it this way. It is a criminal trial, and in that case, juries must be unanimous. So, putting it another way, one juror is enough to prevent a guilty verdict. So, you know, you hear Trump complaining about can't get a fair trial in Manhattan. Well, actually, no. The odds may be in Trump's favor just looking at the politics of it. Our Harry Enten crunched the numbers. Joe Biden won 87% of the vote in Manhattan in 2020. There are 12 jurors. So if you do the math, that means there's about an 80% chance that at least one juror of that 12 is friendly to Trump or is even a Trump supporter, assuming that that jury pool is reflective of Manhattan's electorate. And that one is all Trump needs, just one supporter to sink the government's case into a payment made to adult film star Stormy Daniels just before the 2016 election. The whole trial is about whether that payment was made to influence the election. And tonight, Trump unleashed once again on the judge in the case.
I was recently informed that another corrupt New York judge, Juan Merchan, gagged me. That's gagged like you can't talk. But he gagged me with respect to a case that everyone, including the DA, felt should never have been brought. This judge should be recused and the case should be thrown out. He's totally conflicted. There's never been a judge more conflicted than this one. There has virtually never been anything like it.
Of course, he can say all those things, and the judge, as a judge should, remains quiet and above it. Brinjin Grass is outside the courthouse in Lower Manhattan, where jury selection will begin on Monday morning. And Bryn, you have done extensive reporting here. What are you learning from your sources about the security preparations underway for this unprecedented moment?
Yeah, Erin, it will be a robust security package is how it's continually described to us. It's one that has been practiced and discussed for the last couple of months. Now, listen, this courthouse here behind me, it handles hundreds of cases daily, but this is a trial like no other. It's expected to last 6 to 8 weeks. So law enforcement really on a state, local and federal level needs to have this delicate balance of protecting the public, the former president, while also allowing business as usual.
The crush of media, protesters and supporters, and the complicated task of protecting the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, who is also the defendant.
This whole area is going to look very different come Monday.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, a lot of the area, Bryn, is going to be frozen, you know, for the arrival of the ex-president.
Outside Manhattan Criminal Court, this is where Donald Trump's trial kicks off Monday. Police are preparing for what even they describe as an unprecedented several weeks.
Is there any difference from your standpoint on the ground now that Trump is a presumptive nominee rather than a past president?
Well, that's why I'm saying we're obviously going to ratchet it up.
That means the building will be wrapped in a security blanket of cameras, uniformed officers, drones, bomb-sniffing dogs, and barricades.
This is just a small sample of what's available.
CNN was given a look inside the NYPD's Joint Operations Center, an intelligence and visual hub for the NYPD and its law enforcement partners.
It's a big challenge. It's a lot of moving parts. The attention of the nation and often the world will be on New York City for this entire event.
This is the first criminal trial of a former U.S. president in history. But Donald Trump has been in and out of courtrooms for the past year.
This really is just a continuation of what occurred when he was on the civil trials.
Giving law enforcement a head start on how to prepare and what to expect. It includes being nimble and responding to immediate threats.
We got word of that bomb threat this morning.
Since Trump's indictments, law enforcement says threats against judges, district attorneys, and others have become almost expected.
We're going to be looking at the threat picture on a constant basis. Social media, scrubbing, just listening to people making calls or making threats online.
How do you handle that?
We want to find the basis of the threat. Is it real? Is it an online warrior? Is it, what kind of extra security preparations do we have to take?
It includes also protecting jurors. We're told those picked could possibly be treated the same as jurors in Trump's civil trial against E. Jean Carroll. They may be driven in daily from a secret location for their safety. And moving Trump, who likely will spend most of his nights at Trump Tower, will be a calculated choreography between the NYPD and Secret Service, who have triggered more robust security plans.
Is this unprecedented? Yeah, it is. And that's why we've ratcheted it up to make sure that everything goes off without a hitch and everybody goes home safe.
All right, let me take you inside the courthouse to that 15th floor. That's where the trial is going to take place. It's going to be shut down to the general public come Monday. The elevator the former president uses will also be frozen. Inside that courtroom, Trump will sit at the defense table. Behind him will be Secret Service. And in addition to that, there will also be court officers sitting in pews to create a protective barrier between Trump and the general public. Erin.
It's really incredible to think about it. All right. Thank you so much, Bryn. With all that reporting, let's go now to our legal analysts, Ryan Goodman and Mark O'Mara, criminal defense attorney and former prosecutor. So thanks so much to both of you. Ryan, you hear Bryn and the massive security, all this reporting that she has done. And on Monday, you've got 500 jurors who are going to parade in like they do every Monday. But they're going to go through all of this, right? They're going to be well aware of this moment that they are walking into. Does that have an impact?
I think it must. It's just the gravity of the situation, the enormity of the situation, that it, I would think, impresses upon them the historical moment. And that if they do end up serving on the jury, that they have a task to perform of applying the law to the facts. And it's such a more solemn experience. And the fact of this security presence, I think, gives them an even deeper sense of it, that one hopes that then they perform their duties as they're supposed to as jurors.
So Mark, in the 500 that are going to walk in, right, you're only going to end up with 12 ultimately who are going to be the decision makers. And you have been involved with so many jury selections in high profile, high stakes criminal cases. Trump's team, their goal, right, is to get at least one person on that jury. Just one is all they need, right, to raise a question. And I just shared Harry Enten's math. Just, if you're going to say that these decisions are made on politics, which, of course, Ryan is saying we all hope that they aren't, that people are going to do their duty as citizens. But even looking at it from that perspective, on Manhattan voter rolls, you've got an 80% chance that there will be one juror on that panel who will be a Trump supporter or favorable to Trump. So what is the defense looking for? How difficult is this going to be for them?
Well, actually, I think it's going to be quite easy for the defense from that perspective, because you're right. They have to get somebody on that panel. And we as defense attorneys don't like talking about moving for a hung jury, right? We want an acquittal. But the harsh reality is, the political harsh reality is, he does not want a conviction before the election. And a hung jury will put this case off another couple of 3 months, potentially. So, yes, the defense team is going to be looking for that sympathy jury. That's somebody who is willing to listen to Trump, willing to like Trump before they even walk into a courtroom. And you're right, 20% of the people, even in Manhattan, like him. But nationwide, we know there's a greater percentage of people that have a sympathy or an empathy for Trump. And that's what they're going to be playing towards.
And Ryan, in that context, Trump posts that video today. I played a clip of it, railing against the gag order from the judge, which it may be surprising to a lot of people watching. It was to me. He's allowed to do that.
Yeah.
The gag order actually is saying you can't intimidate witnesses, and you can't do that to family members of the judge. But the judge himself is not included in that. So we're going to see a lot more of this, right? We're going to see a lot more of this as he tries to, inject this uncertainty and poison into the atmosphere around this judge. So the jury's been told not to watch. There's no jury in New York. There's no one who hasn't turned on local news or something and seen some part of this. How do you get around that?
It's very difficult to get around it. Almost, you know, another example is just being a New Yorker, getting in the back seat of a taxi. It starts out with television news, local news, and right. This is going to be the biggest news around.
And it's going to be the jury selection in the Trump criminal trial, right?
Yeah, exactly. And also jurors have families and jurors have friends and colleagues, and this will be a part of the information environment in which everybody is kind of stewing. So the idea that these kinds of statements by former President Trump don't reach the jurors one way or another is hard to believe. And that might, in fact, be part of his strategy, or his strategy might be just the general public, but this is an indirect effect.
It certainly is. I mean, Mark, I know you believe that Trump's team could actually play into the comments that he's been making about the judge to help him at the trial. Walk us through that.
So I think they have to, and they have such great environment within which to do it. Because look, either he is an arrogant person who's ignoring the law and the processes, or he is so innocent and he is so upset with being falsely accused that he has to present himself like that. And quite honestly, if you look at it through that lens, then the defense can lean into it, right? They can say, to the extent you've heard him, because let's face it, as was just said, there is nobody in this panel who has not heard about this case and, for that matter, has not made some predisposition about it. We're not trying to get people who haven't heard. They've been hiding in a corner somewhere. But we want people who will acknowledge what they've heard about it. And the defense can play into that by saying, you've heard my client, you've heard him complain about the process, you've heard him complain about the judge. Are you okay with somebody who believes he is so innocent that he has to speak out? What a great defense question to present.
And I'm glad we have you, because you get a real insight into their worldview, because you've done these crucial defense cases. Thanks very much to both of you. Next, I'm going to speak to O.J. Simpson's longtime manager. He had a roller coaster relationship with Simpson over decades. And tonight, he's going to tell you about it, sharing some of the 70 hours of videos he filmed of Simpson and the details of their last conversation just before Simpson died. Plus, we have new video just into OutFront from the southern border. This video that we've just gotten is a group of migrants crossing into California, evading Mexican authorities right before our cameras. Our David Culver is there. He saw it. He's live in Tijuana after this. And breaking news, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene tonight says she will go ahead with trying to oust Mike Johnson, even if Trump backs Johnson. And she is just speaking to our Manu Raju. We're going to bring that to you next.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support. Your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life.
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Breaking news, the family of Ron Goldman, who was murdered along with Nicole Brown Simpson, speaking out for the first time on the death of O.J. Simpson, saying moments ago, and I quote, "The news of Ron's killer passing away is a mixed bag of complicated emotions and reminds us that the journey through grief is not linear. The hope for true accountability has ended." Simpson was acquitted for murdering Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson in 1995 criminally, part of a spectacular downfall of a football superstar. Tom Foreman covered the O.J. Simpson trial. He was there, he sat in that courtroom, and begins our coverage tonight out front.
Police believe that O.J. Simpson is in that car.
For 2 hours over 60 miles, almost 30 years ago, the low-speed pursuit of an American icon became an American sensation.
People were leaving their homes and their work and wherever they were, and they were racing to these overpasses.
And when the white Bronco stopped for O.J. Simpson to face murder charges over the killing of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown, and Ronald Goldman, the country was hooked.
And that was our first introduction into reality TV and what it looked like, and we were obsessed.
Simpson was a superstar, a Heisman Trophy winner in college, one of the most dazzling running backs in NFL history. For many black families in particular, a runaway success.
Nobody does it better than her.
Juice was a beloved celebrity in commercials and movies.
Norbert!
Hiya, buddy. Hey! Doc says I should be on my bean and as good as new in a week.
And yet his role as defendant eclipsed everything else. Through 11 months of court proceedings and non-stop media coverage, the nation was captivated by daily debates over DNA evidence, police procedure, and dramatic moments made for TV.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
When the verdict came down,
not guilty of the crime of murder,
by one estimate, 150 million people watched live. Many splitting along racial lines over whether the ruling was just or just wrong.
It's just unfair.
A massive civil suit by the victims' families did not go as well for Simpson, and he was ordered to pay tens of millions in damages. He lost his house and Heisman, but kept hundreds of thousands in pension funds.
Our family is grateful for a verdict of responsibility, which is all we ever wanted.
Simpson had future legal problems, too. In 2007, he was arrested after an armed robbery involving sports memorabilia he said was his.
I am sorry. I didn't mean to steal anything from anybody, and I didn't know I was doing anything illegal.
He wound up convicted and sentenced to 33 years in prison. He was paroled in 2017, and through it all, he maintained his innocence in the murders that changed his life. And American society, too.
Right now, I'm at a point in my life where all I want to do is spend time with my, as much time as I can with my children and my friends. And I've done my time.
You know, Tom, it just brings back so many memories for those of us who remember where we were in those moments of verdict of the Bronco. And you were there in that courtroom through so much of this. We've got a video of you. You know, it's obvious who it is. You were covering the O.J. Simpson trial from beginning to end. Tom, what stands out to you the most from all those months that you spent in court?
As those months went by, I didn't spend a lot of time in the courtroom itself. I spent a lot of time covering everything around that and all the analysis outside. One of the things I was really struck by was how early you could see this divergence happening, where parts of the community, in large part the black community, was saying, yes, you have to be suspect of police evidence. You have to be suspect of prosecutors. Yes, we're listening to what the defense has to say. And many people in the white community, the opposite, were like, well, no, you trust the authorities. They have a case here. They're pursuing it. You could see that happening for months before you got to the verdict. So the response after the verdict was really no surprise.
It's really amazing. We remember that white Bronco chase. I remember where I was watching that with a group of people. CNN's Larry King was on the air at the time. And you see him here, the entire country glued to TV, watching all this play out in real time. I mean, really, it changed. This particular moment is a part of now American history, cultural society. Did you have any inkling at that moment you'd be spending the next 16 months of your life covering this case? And what do you remember about that white Bronco chase?
What I remember most of all about the white Bronco, remember, we weren't really in cell phone time at that point. People were picking up landlines and calling everyone and saying, turn on your TV. This astonishing thing is happening. And we're watching this slow motion chase down the road. And we'd seen many car chases in L.A. They were publicized at various times, but nothing like this. And everyone's saying, OJ's in that car. I'm telling you, Aaron, people who didn't live through it, who didn't see O.J. play football like I did back in his day when he was in the NFL, It's hard to understand what a gigantic figure he was, so very, very high, to fall so very, very low.
It is absolutely incredible. And as you say, one of the things even then that stood out was just this odd, sort of suspended nature of it and how slowly it seemed to move. All right, Tom Foreman, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Out front now, Norman Pardo. He was O.J. Simpson's longtime manager and has more than 70 hours of tapes of O.J. during the time that they spent together traveling the country. And Norman, I really appreciate your time tonight. You know, as we think about this and the historical figure that he was, you've known him since 1999. You were part of his inner circle for years. And I know you say there were a lot of different O.J.s. What do you mean by that?
O.J. was like a chameleon. He would change from one O.J. to the next. He'd be a, you know, like a thug O.J. to a, you know, a business O.J. And you couldn't tell the, you know, when he's going to switch. I don't know if he meant to do it all the time, but he did. He would fit into any environment he was at. If it was a bunch of high, you know, rollers, he'd fit right in. If it was a bunch of people, you know, pimps, he'd fit right in. It was just, it was amazing to watch the different OJs appear.
He did post a video in February, so very recently here, very proximate to his death. And I just wanted to play it for you. Here it is, Norman.
My health is good. I mean, obviously, I'm dealing with some issues. But, hey, I think I'm just about over it, and I'll be back on that golf course, hopefully, in a couple of weeks.
As I mentioned, that was just February. And I know you talked to him very recently, much more recently than that, Norman. What was that conversation like, and how did he sound?
He sounded like O.J., just not quite as, you know, I could tell he was damaged by his voice. But at the same token, it was time, I think, for us to get together and talk for a few minutes. We had had a very roller coaster relationship, I guess you would call it. He got extremely angry with me when I was doing that movie, Phil Nicole. He didn't like that at all. He didn't like me contacting the other guy that was willing the night of the murders. So he stopped talking to me. But I don't know you anymore, and he erased me. That's what O.J. does. When he's done with somebody, he just erases them. But then, you know, we got back together, and I think he just wanted to, he knew what was happening to him, and he didn't want to leave in bad terms. That's all I could think.
I mean, you mentioned, obviously, you did in your work at the time, 2013, right? You implicated him in the murders. Was this last call, I guess it sounds like what you're saying, was it a reconciliation after that? I mean, did you get the sense that it was a...
Yes.
I don't want to use the word apology. You tell me what it was like, but a goodbye?
Yeah. It was just he wanted to put it all in the past, and I did too. I said, let's just put it in the past, call it a day, and we both agreed to that. And then we just talked happy talk about the things we had done. And, you know, because you know, sometimes a person, when he gets real sick, wants to hear happy thoughts.
You have recorded, I know, more than 70 hours of tapes of the time you spent together, Norman. As I said, you spent a lot of time together, and you knew him in all these different chameleon OJs, as you said. And at one point of the tapes that you shared with us, there's a song playing about OJ. And in this song, it's about OJ having killed his ex-wife. And he's on your tape listening along. So here's some of that. Do you remember anything about that moment as you were, rolling on him with that song playing?
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating. I thought that was fascinating to watch his expressions. Because it's very rare you get the expressions from somebody who's actually, you know, being called a murderer on, you know, and then singing with them. You know, that's why I put it all on, I don't know if I can mention it, but OJTapes.com is where I put all the tapes, putting them up there. Because I think the public needs to see the different faces of OJ. And maybe they could take a little bit from the tapes that I did. But I thought it was really strange that he would sing with that.
Yeah.
But that's just me. I mean, I don't know. If you look at his expressions, he's getting into the song. You know, ice cream melting and all the whole nine yards.
How could you even looking at him, though,
like
in
I
that
say,
moment?
A lot of faces of us.
Yeah, react to that. I mean, knowing that at that point, you know, you come to the conclusion that you implicated him, that you know, in the murders, that he could sit there and sing along with that song. Could you ever understand the psychology of that, given how well you knew him?
Because I think it's because in his mind, he didn't do it because he didn't actually do the murders. And OJ's not a great guy. He's not that nice of a guy. He's not a bad guy. He's just, is he a murderer? That's the question everybody has to ask themselves. And the only way to do that is actually to watch him, listen to him. He'll tell you everything. It took me 20 years of investigative work to figure out what happened. It wasn't something you're going to learn overnight. Because there's too many smoke and mirrors out there right now.
Well, Norman, now you've had a chance over all these decades to think about it, to study it, and you had that conversation with him just recently. What do you think he leaves behind? I mean, for lack of a better word, what's O.J. Simpson's legacy?
He's going to leave behind a mystery that everybody's going to wonder. Something that people will talk about probably forever. They're teaching it in schools. I mean, that's why I'm on tour now. The schools want me to speak. They want me to, you know, talk about what all happened. And so that's what I'm doing right now. Because people still want to know what happened that night. And they'll never know, now that he's dead.
Well, Norman, I really appreciate your taking the time to speak with me and to share some of this. Thank you.
I appreciate you having me on your show. Thank you.
Can't stop watching that video of him singing along to the song about him killing her. Well, coming up on CNN, Lara Coates has a special hour at 11 on the life and death of O.J. Simpson. You're going to want to tune into that. And next, we have new video just into out front of migrants evading Mexican authorities illegally crossing into California. We just got this video. Our David Culver is there, saw it. We're going to take you live to Tijuana, Mexico to see exactly how they did it. And breaking news, new images just into out front of the sailors who were rescued after being stranded on a remote island. They spelled the word help on the sand, and a Coast Guard commander will be speaking out about the rescue for the first time out front. Tonight, we have new video just into out front. This is video from the southern border. We have a drone there, and it captured a group of migrants illegally crossing into California and heading towards U.S. Border Patrol officers. They were able to evade Mexican authorities, who say they're ramping up enforcement on their side of the border to keep migrants from reaching the U.S. So our David Culver is out front there at the border in Tijuana, Mexico. And David, it was you and your team who captured this video of these migrants as they were crossing the border. What did you see? How did they do it?
Hey there, Aaron. Yeah, we're here with migration officials from the Mexican side, and we've been spending the past couple days trying to get a better sense of these revamped efforts to try to stop folks from illegally crossing. And it's interesting because having covered the border now for several months and going back even more than a year, this is the toughest level of enforcement I have seen at the U.S.-Mexico border. And it's coming from the Mexico side right now. And the video that you pointed out, we were there with Mexican officials as they were showing us some of the vulnerable spots on the wall. And that, to answer your question, is how many of these migrants are still getting through. They'll either, as you can even see behind me, use portions of the wall and have equipment to cut out little squares. And usually they're doing that with smugglers who are backed by cartels and able to get in. Or you can even see up here on this portion of the wall, there's markings higher up, and there's a lot of them. They have made these ladders that essentially they'll throw up and then they'll scale up the wall and continue down the other side. Now, when they get to the other side of this one here, they're on U.S. territory, but there's yet another wall in this portion that keeps them from entering the U.S. right away. So they have to be processed, and many of them are trying to get those claims for asylum processed by U.S. officials, Aaron.
It is amazing, David, what you're showing us, what you're seeing in plain sight, the markings, the places to throw the ladders up, just seeing it so tangibly. And these crossings, I mean, obviously you've got, the United States has a crisis on its hands. But what's fascinating from what sounds like what you're saying is it's Mexican authorities who are taking action, that residents in Mexico are increasingly frustrated with the migration crisis as well. So what are you seeing on that?
So we were hearing that, and we wanted to see it firsthand, Aaron, and that's why we came down here and wanted to spend some time with Mexican officials and to see what they have put together as far as these new efforts is quite striking, because it is in many places along the border much more than you'd see from the U.S. side as far as a law enforcement presence. As far as what residents think, and I'm going to show you where we are because this gives a better context. This is actually a neighborhood here. If you pan, this is a private community that backs up right to the U.S.-Mexico border. And it's interesting because we've been in touch with residents on the U.S. side, and they're angry, and they have shared with us over the past several months that they have these migrants coming through their property, and that is frustrating them. The same type of frustration is felt here on the Mexico side, and communities like this is actually a private wall, are dealing with smugglers who will come through, and they'll drop off groups of migrants in areas like this, and then even in this portion, you can see they have pulled back some of the barbed wire on this private cement wall, and they use that then to climb over the actual border wall. And so what has now been the result? Well, the folks in this community have petitioned their state's governor of Baja California, who in turn has had the Mexican National Guard, and we saw this just a couple of hours ago, patrolling neighborhoods like this one. So you have to imagine that, Aaron. You have in your own community National Guard's member, at least here on the Mexico side, now coming through and setting up camp in some places to patrol. And tomorrow we're going to have much more on some of the remote camps that Mexican officials have deployed to and set up an infrastructure. And we're going to show you that exclusively when we join you 24 hours from now.
Wow, it is absolutely incredible. And it's just so amazing when you see them actually just walking through the scrub there. It's just that instability, that uncertainty that is so pervasive and permeating both sides of the border from what you're showing. All right, David Culver, thank you. David mentioned, and he will have that exclusive report out front tomorrow, that rare look at the conditions on the ground at some of those remote sections of the border wall where he's going to take you tomorrow. And you don't want to miss that. So we'll see you tomorrow, David.
Thanks.
All right. And I want to go now to the Democratic congressman from New York, Tom Suozzi. He's on the House Homeland Security Committee. He won the special election to replace Congressman George Santos in large part because of his focus on border security, which you were incredibly focused on, Congressman Suozzi. So you heard David Culver's report, and I don't know if you could see the return, but it is incredibly powerful to look at the wall and see the markings where the ladders are thrown up, where the barbed wire is pulled back. The context here, Congressman, we've got a new Axios poll tonight that finds 42% of Latino adults in America support a wall or a fence along the U.S.-Mexico border. And that is not just maybe larger than many listening may expect. It is also up 12 points in the past 3 years. Should President Biden be hearing this as a blaring wake-up call?
Absolutely. This is a problem that the American people are concerned about. And I've always said that the best elected official, the best politician, is the one who says what the people are thinking already. And the people of the United States of America, whether they're Republicans, independents, or Democrats, are concerned about the border. They're concerned about what they see on your show tonight, what they see as chaos. And, you know, a wall's not going to solve it by itself, but listen, make it part of the solution. Let's get a bipartisan solution like the Senate bill that was negotiated by James Lankford, one of the most honest, ethical, conservative Republicans in the Senate, along with Senator Chris Murphy and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Sinema. Let's use that bipartisan compromise and let's push it forward.
Well, part of the reason that this is hitting such a chord, there are many reasons, but is also the fear of the unknown. What is coming across the border? Okay. And the former National Intelligence Director, James Clapper, I recently had a conversation with him, Congressman. He told me that he's, quote, very concerned about terrorists exploiting the southern border. He said it was, in his words, a serious national security concern. In that context, today, the FBI director, Chris Wray, warned about his growing concern, and I want to use his words directly, about the potential for a coordinated attack here in the homeland akin to the ISIS-K attack we saw at the Russia concert hall. Now, in that concert hall, the Crocus, 144 people were killed. What more do you know about Chris Wray's warning?
I know that people are concerned. People are worried. That uncertainty of what's going to happen because of this open border is making people worried. And we have to recognize that, you know, people said to me during my campaign and even now, oh, the border, that's a Republican issue. No, it's not. It's an American issue, and we must address it. Now, the president has started addressing it much more. He talked about it in the beginning of his administration. Now he's talking about it more, and I'm hoping he'll take some unilateral action, and we can force a bipartisan compromise, because we had a deal on the table that was endorsed by the Wall Street Journal, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, even the Border Patrol Union president, who's a big Trumper, endorsed the deal. And President Trump swooped in and said, oh, I don't want to give Biden a victory. I want to run on the chaos. Well, that's unacceptable. Let's make a deal. Let's actually address this very real problem.
All right. You just, as I mentioned, obviously your House Homeland Security. You did also just return from Ukraine. And so I'm sure that what we heard today from the American General Chris Cavoli, who happens to be the head of the U.S. European Command and the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, stood out to you. I mean, it stopped me in my tracks. He said, Russia's military, again, I want to quote him directly, has grown back to what they were before the war began. I mean, that is incredible, Congressman. We've been, you know, you're hearing about the decimation of the military, their inability to provide for it, their inability to mobilize, mass death of Russians on the front lines. And now we're hearing they're back to the way they were before the war began. Congressman, it's shocking. I mean, this seems to be proof at least of the inefficacy, perhaps even the failure of U.S. sanctions, to say the very least.
The sanctions have to be enforced more strongly, but we need to recognize Russia is conscripting more soldiers. They're building more weapons plants. Ukraine has done a fantastic job fighting back, but right now they're running out of ammunition, and we need to help them. As you heard the Japanese prime minister say today, this is important for all democracies throughout the world. And there was I was happily surprised to see how much bipartisan support there was for the prime minister of Japan's comments about the need to fund Ukraine and to support Ukraine. That support is in the United States Congress. We need Speaker Johnson to put it on the floor, stop letting Marjorie Taylor Greene and the other extremists block him. Let's get this on the floor. I promise it will pass.
All right. Well, Congressman Suozzi, I very much appreciate your time. And you just mentioned Speaker Johnson and Marjorie Taylor Greene. We do have breaking news because Marjorie Taylor Greene has just spoken to our Manu Raju moments ago. And she's updated him about her plans to oust the Speaker Mike Johnson, even if he has Trump's support. So Manu has a breaking details there. Plus, we have more breaking news because for the first time tonight, you're going to hear from a Coast Guard commander who spotted the word help on that sand of a remote island, leading to the rescue of three sailors. We also have new pictures of their rescue this hour for you.
The assignment with me, Audie Cornish.
So there have been arrests, suspensions, disciplinary hearings. They're shutting down graduation events.
At this moment, the part of the protests that are admirable are young people calling attention to atrocities.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University.
I would like to make a space for them to do that, as long as that space doesn't prevent other people from pursuing their education.
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
I think the motion to vacate is also being supported by quite a few members in our conference. That's it. That's an internal House issue with our elected Speaker of the House. Totally two separate issues. Hopefully I have they have a great meeting tomorrow.
In the middle of the most precarious moment of his rookie speakership,
I think the sword hangs over Mike Johnson's neck.
Speaker Johnson making the trip to Mar-a-Lago tomorrow to appear side by side with former President Trump and talk about what the Speaker's office is billing as election integrity. The pivotal meeting coming as Speaker Johnson is fighting for his political life from a challenge from Trump's close ally, Marjorie Taylor Greene.
I absolutely love President Trump. I have a great relationship with him.
Marjorie Taylor Greene escalating her threats against the Speaker to oust him.
The current Speaker of the House we have right now is getting rolled in every single meeting. He is negotiating from weakness.
Only intensifying the thorny intra-party relationships that Johnson and Trump are attempting to navigate when they appear together tomorrow, with stakes high for their party in an election year.
Mike Johnson he's literally turned into Mitch McConnell's twin, and worse. He's a Democrat.
Sources tell CNN that amid Green's threat, allies of Johnson have asked Trump to either publicly support the Speaker or at least stay out of it altogether. And sources close to Johnson don't dispute the timing of the visit, potentially only helping Johnson. Though this was a pre-planned event, this is not inconvenient for us. It's convenient for us. acknowledging the speaker's appearance with Trump is beneficial for them right now. The meeting coming only 2 days after Trump dealt Speaker Johnson an embarrassing blow, defying Johnson and Republican leadership, Trump urging House Republicans to kill the reauthorization of the controversial surveillance law FISA, leading to its failure on a procedural vote. Despite this, Johnson and Trump have been slowly growing their relationship since Johnson's surprise assent to the gavel.
At this time yesterday, nobody was thinking of Mike. And then we put out the word, and now he's the Speaker of the House.
Johnson, an election denier,
the Constitution was clearly violated in the 2020 election,
has visited Trump at Mar-a-Lago at least twice and endorsed him in November.
I was one of the closest allies that President Trump had in Congress.
Johnson's predecessor, former Speaker Kevin McCarthy, was even closer to Trump.
I think the president has done a tremendous job.
When Trump personally helped him get elected speaker, it was then Marjorie Taylor Greene who stepped in, fielding calls from Trump to help sway McCarthy's opposers.
Mr. Speaker.
A mere 4 months later, it was Trump, however, that declined saving his job when McCarthy was faced with his own rebellion from his right flank. A fate Johnson is hoping to avoid.
And these intra-party dynamics and this threat to Speaker Johnson providing quite the backdrop going into tomorrow's meeting. A source close to the speaker tells me tonight that they would, of course, welcome anything that President Trump wants to say in support of Speaker Johnson. But they're not aware, even at this late hour, how much or how little he will get into it, that he is the one that ultimately decides. Erin? Sondland, thank you very much. And next, we do have breaking news. We've just gotten some new images of the three sailors who were rescued after being stranded on a remote island in the Pacific Ocean. And we're hearing for the first time from one of the pilots who found them after he saw the word help spelled out on the beach. Breaking news, and this breaking news is a miraculous story that we are happy to report. Outfront has just spoken to a Coast Guard pilot responsible for the rescue of three fishermen on a remote island in the Pacific Ocean. They made this help sign out of palm leaves after their boat hit a coral reef and started taking on water. And they took shelter on this extremely small, uninhabited island. So a Coast Guard plane goes out flying, hoping against hope, searching for the men, and literally spots the plea for help spelled out. And that pilot is speaking out now to Outfront tonight.
We could see it from a couple thousand feet up in the air. We noticed the island first, and then on the first circle, we were able to see the help sign. We were later able to tell that it was made out of palm fronds. We were able to establish communications with them via handheld radio. They all confirmed that they were thirsty and hadn't had water for a while, but that they were able to receive the survival kit from the Navy P-8 that responded from Kadena, Japan. And so they said that their medical condition was good, and they didn't require anything else.
It's amazing. And Commander Arnold and his team rescued them. The men had lived on the island for more than a week, surviving off coconuts and what little water they could get. And in another incredible twist, when the Coast Guard reached the island, we've learned the three men were surprised to hear that one of the rescuers who came along actually speaking in their local language, even more surprised to learn that the three fishermen and that rescuer were related, distant cousins. An incredible story. And now tonight, payback. Former President Trump is determined to address his personal grievances and punish his political enemies if he's reelected. And we've got new reporting from CNN's Phil Mattingly. And Phil is going to show you exactly who Trump is going after, what he plans to do, and how. Phil Mattingly is out front.
This is a disgraceful thing. This is a third world country.
Just days before Donald Trump becomes the first former president to go on criminal trial.
It's all coming out of the DOJ. A thing like this has never happened before.
His unyielding and fact-challenged rhetorical defense on the campaign trail obscured a stark reality.
These radical left lunatics want to interfere with our elections by using law enforcement.
What he alleges is the exact authority Trump plans to claim in a second term, according to a CNN review of campaign policy proposals and conversations with advisors and allies. The threats leveled at his opponents.
I will appoint a real special prosecutor to go after the most corrupt president in the history of the United States of America, Joe Biden.
Ready to be acted on if voters return him to the Oval Office. As one Washington Republican who talks to the Trump campaign framed it, Democrats hit first, we are going to hit back harder. When confronted with the lack of any evidence of White House involvement, the Republican said that's what he believes, that's what his people believe. And unlike last time, this is his party now. And many voters don't seem to mind. Trump has repeatedly attacked prosecutors and judges, their families, their relationships, former officials, and his political opponents. He called for former GOP Congresswoman Liz Cheney and the rest of the January 6th committee to be jailed. He's even floated execution of the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The guy accused the president of being on cocaine last week, and nobody even blinked, one Biden campaign official said when asked about Trump's strength in the polls. After all, this animating feature of Trump's 2016 campaign never actually came to fruition. And though Trump's affinity for vengeance existed long before that first campaign,
if given the opportunity, I will get even with some people that were disloyal to me.
And was often raised in his first term.
One of my favorite preoccupations during my time as national security advisor was counting how many times Trump said John Kerry should be prosecuted.
It ran headlong into advisors, Congress, and the courts, loath to bend to his will.
I am your warrior. I am your justice. And for those who have been wronged and betrayed, I am your retribution. I am your retribution.
This time is different. Four indictments and 88 felony charges have sharpened Trump's privately raised desire for revenge.
If they do this, they've already done it. But if they want to follow through on this, it could certainly happen in reverse.
Congressional Republicans who push back on Trump are gone or on their way out, almost always replaced by loyalists who owe their election to Trump's endorsement. Federal courts blocked or forced withdrawal of an unprecedented number of Trump rules. They are now stocked with hundreds of young and sharply conservative Trump appointees. At the same moment, Trump and his advisors embrace a maximalist theory on his presidential authority. The advisors who blocked Trump's wishes replaced by Trump devotees.
I put great people in, but I also put people that I made a mistake with.
Who form the backbone of expansive policy proposals targeting Justice Department, national security, and intelligence officials, laying the groundwork to terminate career government officials deemed insufficiently loyal.
We need to make it much easier to fire rogue bureaucrats who are deliberately undermining democracy.
And with Trump escalating his rhetorical warfare in advance of his trial next week on charges brought by the New York District Attorney, it should be noted there's a policy proposal for that, too.
I will direct a completely overhauled DOJ to investigate every radical DA and AG in America for their illegal, racist, in reverse enforcement of the law.
Aaron, I think the point here is this. There's no question next week Donald Trump faces the highest stakes legal challenge of his career. But if he survives that first criminal trial and any other that occurs over the course of the coming 8 months and wins re-election, he will enter the Oval Office emboldened personally and with more power than we've seen probably in decades from a president and a team who are not hiding this. They're making very clear what they want to do, how they want to do it, and that their supporters want them to deliver, Aaron.
Incredible. Say, listen to what someone tells you. All right, Phil Mattingly, thank you very much. And thanks to all of you. It's time for Anderson.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/Call Me Country. Max subscription required.